Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of the mindrenewed.com, podcasting to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And today it is my great pleasure to be speaking to Dr. Frederik von Saal. Dr. von Saal is Curator's Professor in the Division of Biological Sciences at the University of Missouri, Columbia, specializing in sexual differentiation, maternal-fetal physiology, hormones and behavior, and a member of the Endocrine Disruptors Research Group in the university. And although his impressively long list of peer-reviewed publications stretch back almost 40 years, he is best known, certainly outside academia, for his openly expressed health concerns about the chemical bisphenol A, or BPA, which is to be found in many of the plastics that we use on an everyday basis. And it's to discuss that subject that he kindly joins us today. So may I say, Dr. von Saal, it's a great privilege to have you on the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, pleasure to be talking with you.
Now, this subject of BPA first came to my attention about 3 or 4 years ago when I saw a couple of news reports on YouTube in which you were interviewed and you were expressing some, well, I have to say, really very grave concerns about this material and saying that it is used extremely widely in many of the products that we use and that there is a growing body of research that's linking BPA to quite a long list of human health problems. But before we get into a discussion of all that, would you mind telling us a little bit more about your background and what it is that you do? Because I'm quite sure that words like endocrine disruptors and the like are not familiar to, well, probably the majority of my audience. Also, insofar as it might be relevant to our discussion, could you give us a brief layperson's glimpse of what an endocrine disruptor actually is as well?
Yes, my background is in reproductive endocrinology and neurobiology, focusing on developmental effects of hormones. And so a endocrine disruptor refers to a chemical that can interfere with the hormonal signals that control the development of organs during fetal life and then control the functioning of those organs later on. And an example would be the hormones testosterone and estrogen, estradiol. And these two sex hormones control development of the reproductive system. And then in adulthood, they control the functioning of the reproductive system. And just as an example, if female fetuses are exposed to higher than normal levels of testosterone, they can come out with the external appearance, the genitals, of a male, because that's not genetically controlled, that's hormonally controlled. So an endocrine disruptor is a chemical that interferes with the ability of the natural hormones in the body to control those normal developmental processes. And it's not just the reproductive system, it's the brain, the immune system, the skeletal system, the amount of fat you have, the whole metabolic control systems that determine how you grow and function. So these chemicals have the ability to disrupt just about every aspect of the way a person functions.
And this material, BPA, is one of those disruptors. And I suppose it's going to seem a bit cliched to ask the question. I'm going to ask it anyway, because I think we have to get some sort of handle on this subject before we get into any detail. Could you give us a brief description of what kind of substance bisphenol A is and what there is about it that should be of particular concern to us?
Bisphenol A is, as the name implies, a phenolic compound. And it turns out that many phenols, and BPA is one of a very large class of compounds, that are able to interact with the receptors that allow estrogens to cause effects in the human body and in animals. And so BPA is actually an estrogenic drug that back in the 1930s was considered for use as a drug. Instead, other chemicals ended up being used as estrogenic drugs. And in the 1950s, chemists who had no background to allow them to understand that this actually was a chemical that was an estrogen, a sex hormone. Without thinking about that, they used it to make a kind of hard, clear plastic called polycarbonate, and also used it to make resins that line cans. It's used as composite for tooth sealants and tooth replacement. It has many, many different uses. It's used in paints, glues, CDs are made from it, and helmets and windshields. So the really big problem is it's used as a plastic material that food is put in, it lines cans, and it's coated on the surface of receipt paper and airline tickets and ATM machine receipts. And when you touch those receipts, your skin is full of BPA from coming in contact with them. So there are many ways that we're exposed to this chemical through food, through air, and also from our skin from coming in contact with products such as thermal paper.
Mm-hmm. So why is it used so much? I mean, I guess there must be many different reasons for all the different products that are out there, but what would you say are some of the main reasons why manufacturers are so drawn to this substance?
Well, that's an interesting question. For plastic, it actually has the appearance of a hard substance that is glass-like. What any chemist will actually tell you is that while it has that appearance, it's an illusion because, in fact, the molecule that makes up the polycarbonate, which is just chains of bisphenol A molecules, is actually a relatively unstable polymer. And particularly when heated or exposed to an acidic substance or an alkaline substance, for instance, an acidic substance would be tomato sauce. In a can that's lined with bisphenol A lining, you're going to get a breakdown of the chains of BPA into free BPA. And in its free form, it's going to act like a sex hormone.
You say that this leaches out under certain circumstances. In an acidic environment, it leaches out from the lining into the food itself.
Absolutely. And one of the things you have to think about is when food is put in cans, it's heated to hundreds of degrees to sterilize it. And if you take high heat and acid and you put that in contact with these chains of bisphenol A molecules, the chains are broken apart. And because bisphenol A, in its way it's used in plastic and in the lining of cans, it is not heat resistant and it's not resistant to acidic substances.
Now, this all would sound okay if there was no possibility of it being a problem for human health, but one of the things that triggered my interest in this subject was the claim that you made in those reports that I saw that there is, in fact, a growing body of research around the globe that links BPA to many, many different diseases in human beings. And I know this is probably too big a question to ask, but I'm going to ask you it anyway, if you don't mind. Could you give us some kind of list as to the possible ill effects of this material?
Yeah, so up until about 5 or 6 years ago, we had hundreds of studies from animals showing a wide range of harm of BPA. But over the last 5 years, there have been over 60 studies identifying harm in humans. So what I'm going to tell you is from over 60 studies that have reported this kind of harm in people. So let's take the female reproductive system. First of all, there's a disease called polycystic ovary disease, ovarian disease, PCOS. This means that the woman's ovaries are not functioning properly. She's not producing normal oocytes and her ovaries are not responding properly to hormones. BPA is implicated in that. And then we and other people have reported in the scientific publications that there's a decrease in the ability of eggs produced by women to be fertilized associated with their BPA levels, with the quality of the embryos they're producing, with the ability of these embryos to implant into the uterus and to establish a pregnancy. And they're associated with abnormalities in the woman's uterus and her ability to respond normally to hormones. Women have a greater incidence of miscarriage, of premature delivery. So all aspects of becoming pregnant and having a normal baby develop, the probability of that happening normally is decreased as the levels of BPA in a woman's body go up. And then finally, BPA is related to breast cancer. In extensive animal research on that, and also human data. And then on the male side, the male is also contributing to fertility problems when couples are having fertility problems. First of all, male sexual function is impaired in relation to his BPA levels. His sperm quality is impaired, and his normal sex hormone levels are rendered not normal as BPA levels get higher. And a real critical part of BPA is that it's actually related to obesity and diabetes, type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, and hypertension. You know, so this is one of the major issues in public health. Not only are people's fertility somehow being compromised in many countries around the world, including the UK, but obesity is becoming a global epidemic, and so is type 2 diabetes, and BPA is related to that. And it's related to underlying abnormalities in the immune system, in abnormal kidney and liver function, and behavioral and neurobiological changes, such as decreased IQ and aggression changes. Again, these are human studies. All of the things I just told you, there are literally hundreds of studies in experimental animals showing exactly the same things.
It is an astonishing list that you've just given us. Can I just go back to the male fertility question? It's often said that in the Western world that fertility rates are declining rapidly. Do you think there's a possibility that BPA is a substantial contributor to that?
Well, it is definitely a contributor because that's what the animal experimental data and the human epidemiological data show. What we're unable to say at this point is because so many, there are over 1,000 endocrine disrupting chemicals that have been identified, but only a few of them, such as bisphenol A, have been extensively studied. So we don't have that kind of understanding that we can say what proportion of these problems is due to any specific chemical or set of events, because there's so much information lacking that we would need to have to answer that question with any kind of confidence.
So from what you said, would I understand you correctly to think it's not just BPA, but in fact there are lots of other of these endocrine disruptors, that we're living in a kind of soup of these things?
Absolutely, that is correct. But the reason that BPA floats to the top of everybody's list is that there are over 10 billion pounds of this made a year. The estimate is that within a few years, we'll be up to 17 to 18 billion pounds of BPA used in products every year. So this is one of the highest volume chemicals in production worldwide. And so there is literally no population found anywhere in the world, in a developed or undeveloped countries. Everybody sampled essentially has BPA in them. So it is a global contaminant, and that's why people are so frightened about it.
And one thing I wanted to ask you is why it is of special concern in the early stages of life, because this is something you bring out in a lecture that I saw a couple of days ago on YouTube, and you said that this was especially crucial in the developing child.
Well, the endocrine system does two things. It is the coordinator of development. And if you disrupt the hormonal signals that have to occur at very specific times in development, then those developmental processes that should occur at that time will not occur normally. And the consequence of that is that once you go through essentially a developmental fork in the road where a tissue that needs to develop does not develop in the way it should, that can never be reversed. All you have then is a medical problem that has to be dealt with for the rest of that person's life. So we look at the developing baby, fetal and newborn in particular, and through childhood and even through adolescence, during development, if you short-circuit developing systems, they can never be made later on in life to develop normally. And then you just have to treat that person and that abnormality for the rest of that person's life.
And yet we have the situation where baby bottles are used all the time and milk is warmed up and there's that direct exposure there to the child. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, that's why baby bottles became one of the first and most obvious targets. And they've been banned in many states in the United States. Mm-hmm. So legislation has really focused on getting rid of them. And in fact, none of the major baby bottle manufacturers even use bisphenol A in baby bottles anymore. The problem is people keep these old baby bottles around, and there are probably still millions of polycarbonate BPA containing baby bottles that people are still using. And if you have any old baby bottles that are hard and clear and don't say BPA free, get rid of them. Don't use them.
And when did that policy change in manufacturing?
The policy changed about 5 years ago. Up until that time, the baby bottle industry fought like crazy that BPA was completely safe. And then finally, the public just pretty much said, we won't buy this anymore. And in Japan, this occurred in the late 90s. In North America and in Europe, it really occurred in, about 4 or 5 years ago. And actually, the bottle manufacturers agreed to have the FDA 2 years ago ban BPA in baby bottles.
And one question I want to ask about the plastic bottles is it any guide looking at the numbers on the bottom of the bottle?
Well, unfortunately, the code for BPA is number 7. If it says 7 inside of the recycling triangle, which is kind of strange because BPA is not a recyclable plastic, but it will have a code number 7. And if it's BPA, it'll say also PC, polycarbonate. The thing is that there are other kinds of plastics that could be also associated with the number 7 because it really is an other than the above category. Number 1 through 6 are specific types of plastic, and number 7 is all the others. And it's always been assumed that a 7 was BPA because it's the only one of the other than the above chemicals that is produced at this massive multi-billion pound per year quantity.
Now, I think one of the most concerning claims that you make, or it's commonly said that the quantities of BPA ingested by consumers is far too small to have any harmful effect, but you contest that. But let me just quote what the website factsaboutbpa.org says about this. Let me quote from them. "We know from recent scientific research that because of the way BPA is processed in the body, it is very unlikely that BPA from typical human exposures could cause health effects. Based on data from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, CDC, typical exposure to BPA is 1,000 times below government safety limits," which of course makes it sound like it's okay. But your claim, if I've understood you correctly, is that this is not actually true, that it's safe at these levels, because even extremely small quantities of this substance can be significantly potent and so harmful to human health. Could I ask you to explain how it could be then that such extremely small quantities can have this effect?
Yes. Well, first of all, it's important to identify that the quote from BPA.org is from the American Chemistry Council, the public relations and lobbying arm of the chemical industry. And they are not exactly out there to tell you about the accurate science about BPA. They're out there selling these products. So what is the actual truth about this? And it goes back to the fact that BPA is not just a poison. It isn't your classic toxic chemical. It's a sex hormone. And sex hormone operates by binding to what is called a hormone receptor. And these receptors operate to pull out of the blood, where there are 1,000 different molecules flowing by a cell, and this receptor grabs onto the one thing that it's evolved to grab onto. And in the case of the estrogen receptor, that's an estrogen molecule as it flows by the cell. And that receptor ignores all other kinds of chemicals. But because BPA is recognized by that receptor as an estrogen, that receptor can bind onto a BPA molecule. And when it does that, it takes that signal from one molecule and it amplifies it. It's like whispering into a microphone and having a sound that's like a bomb going off. Because the final amplified response caused by that single molecule is absolutely tremendous. And my colleagues and I have published papers in endocrine journals called Large Effects from Very Small Exposures, because your natural hormone systems operate where one molecule in a trillion molecules, what is called a part per trillion, can actually stimulate hormonal responses. This is where our hormonal systems operate. And in traditional toxicology, studying traditional harmful, poisonous type of molecules, the toxicologist is studying chemicals in the part per thousand range, literally a million to a billion times higher than the levels of hormones and hormonally active chemicals like BPA. They operate at this extremely low concentration. And the problem is, in traditional toxicology, nobody ever conceived of a toxicant acting like a sex hormone. And so it wasn't built into the thinking that this kind of exceedingly low level could ever be harmful. But just like you would not want a baby to be exposed to the estrogen in a birth control pill, or a fetus to be exposed to an estrogen in a birth control pill, you don't want them to be exposed to BPA that has the same effects that the estrogen in a birth control pill would have, and at staggeringly low concentrations. And earlier in life you get, the more sensitive the body is to these disruptive effects.
And you're talking here in terms of parts per trillion, or one part per trillion here. So would I be right in thinking that really there is no safe level of BPA?
That's where the field of endocrinology and the International Endocrine Society last year published a statement of principles that are the fundamental principles of endocrinology that the toxicological community and the regulatory community, such as the European Food Safety Authority and the Food and Drug Administration, that they are not applying the principles of endocrinology to assess the harm that's possible due to exposure to endocrine disrupting chemicals like BPA. Mm-hmm. So the endocrine community is trying to get the regulatory community and the toxicological community to accept that this is a very unique type of harm caused by a unique type of environmental contaminant that acts like a hormone instead of a traditional poison.
Okay, so do we have a situation where different parties in this argument then are to some extent talking past each other because they're working with different paradigms, really? It's not really about, not fundamentally about the evidence, it's about a different paradigm.
Absolutely, and the consequence is that the regulators are looking at these literally hundreds of studies published about BPA in endocrine journals and saying, well, this is not traditional toxicology, so we don't know how to apply these findings to our toxicological assessments. And therefore, when EFSA did a risk assessment of BPA, it completely ignored the entire scientific literature on BPA, except for two traditional toxicological studies published by the chemical industry that used techniques that predate essentially the field of endocrinology that would have been used in an experiment 100 years ago.
Would you say then that the chemical industry is to some extent guilty of exploiting this confusion?
Absolutely. I published an article in 2005 in the leading environmental journal called Environmental Health Perspectives, published by the United States National Institute of Health, in which I pointed out, just based on an analysis of the literature, that 100% of industry-funded studies came to the conclusion that BPA was completely safe, even though in those studies, that's not actually what the data showed. But over 90% of non-industry funded studies, and again, we're up to well over 300 now, show a staggering array of harm at these unbelievably low doses that the regulatory system still insists are completely safe, even though there are hundreds of studies showing that that is absolutely not true. But they just say, well, they're not studies that we understand and we don't know how to interpret them, so we'll just pretend they don't exist.
I guess another counterclaim that is made is that human beings metabolize BPA so quickly and so efficiently, they get rid of it so that it's not a problem in that way. How would you respond to that?
Well, actually, in 2011, we published an article, again, in this journal, Environmental Health Perspectives, NIH journal, showing that mice, monkeys, and humans metabolize bisphenol A essentially identically. And that is very counterintuitive. It was not what we expected, but that's actually what the data show. But the actual answer to that also is that if bisphenol A is administered using the traditional approach in toxicology, where a tube is put down an animal's throat and BPA is put directly into the stomach, or there's one human study that's been done where they administered BPA in a pill so it went into the stomach, then in fact less than 1% of it becomes biologically active in terms of the amount that gets into blood from the stomach. But the problem is when we consume food, we put it in our mouth. And if you were having a heart attack, you would take nitroglycerin and put it under your tongue. Why would you do that instead of just taking it in a pill? Because if you take it in a pill, the large majority of it is metabolized. If you put it under your tongue, 100% of it immediately goes into your bloodstream. And all of that, 100% of it, is available. And the whole process of how humans are actually exposed to BPA from food, which is through their mouth into their stomach, is completely being misinterpreted based on studies where it's put directly into the stomach, bypassing a major uptake route into blood in humans.
I want to ask you about the FDA itself. Now, in some previous interviews that I heard you give, you've been very, very critical of the Food and Drug Administration there in the US, which, of course, has the responsibility to protect public health through regulating food safety. And you said that for one reason or another, they seem to be very resistant to taking your kind of research on board. But I note that in a recent publication on their website called Bisphenol A Use in Food Contact Application, it was first published in 2010, it's been updated in 2012 and then in this year, they do seem to acknowledge some of these adverse effects that you're mentioning. Let me quote from their overview. Studies employing standardized toxicity tests have thus far supported the safety of current low levels of human exposure to BPA. However, on the basis of results from recent studies using novel approaches to test for subtle effects, both the National Toxicology Program at the National Institutes of Health and FDA have some concern about the potential effects of BPA on the brain, behavior, and prostate gland in fetuses, infants, and young children. And then they list a number of measures, interim measures, to minimize public exposure. So my question to you here is, do you see this as a real change in the attitude of the FDA?
Well, they're between a rock and a hard place, because we have a law called the Toxic Substance Control Act and various laws that govern FDA. And they were written by industry for industry to protect chemicals in commerce, not the public. And in that same release that you just read from, you will also find a little farther down in there a statement from the assistant commissioner of the FDA who actually states, well, one of our problems is we do not have the legal authority to even ask what products BPA is being used in, and we have no authority to regulate it unless new laws are passed or new rules would be created that allow us to do that.
So these interim measures that they talk about then are merely suggestions to the industry?
Essentially, the federal regulatory system in the United States is trapped by outdated regulations that essentially practically all chemicals used in products are declared generally regarded as safe. And then in order to remove them from the market, it has to be proven that they're causing immense harm in people. The exact opposite of the standard to put a drug into commerce, you have to identify that it does what it's supposed to do and that the benefits outweigh the harm. So this is based on extensive testing, whereas in chemicals used in products, before they're actually put into commerce, there's no testing done. And this is where in Europe, the legislation called REACH is actually adopting some of the standards used to allow drugs on the market and applying that set of principles that chemicals have to be tested before they're allowed to be put into products. And we want to make sure that chemicals in commerce, particularly high volume chemicals like BPA, that they're removed from products if they're shown to be endocrine disruptors, which BPA is, and they're not replaced by worse or at least as bad chemicals. That's happened before when flame retardants called brominated diphenyl ethers replaced chlorinated biphenols, and with the idea of putting a bromine on these phenols would make a difference and make the chemical safe, whereas chlorine would not be safe. And then 30 years later, everybody's desperately trying to get rid of the brominated compounds because they're just as bad. So we got rid of the chlorine and replaced it with a set of products that were as bad or worse. And we just can't keep going through that. And that requires pre-market testing. The United States cannot get that legislation through our Congress, but Europe has managed to do that.
So the situation in the US then is that the chemical industry can pretty much put anything they like into products, and then it has to be shown by somebody that this is a problem before it can be acted upon.
What you said is absolutely correct.
That's an astonishing state to be in, isn't it?
Well, actually, because we live in a global market, if countries in Europe act to remove a chemical, then it really becomes a global event. And if you go back to 1999, when the Europeans acted to remove a class of chemicals called phthalates from baby sucking toys or sucking items that babies would put in their mouth, even though it was only legislation passed by the European Parliament, within 6 months, not one product was being sold in the United States with those chemicals in it. Because, you know, corporations selling in the United States were also selling in Europe, and they lost the European market. So Europe can drive the train. The American system is always going to be, mm-hmm. you know, the end of the tail. We're going to be the last to do anything. And that has really been the tradition for any kind of environmental regulation. It's come from outside the United States first, and then we're the last to get on board.
So would that mean that you place more faith in the European Food Safety Authority?
Well, unfortunately, the European Food Safety Authority is, if you look at a recent article in Le Monde, the major French newspaper, front page article on the conflict of interest with panels, people serving on European Food Safety Authority panels, that this is a serious, serious credibility problem for the European Food Safety Authority, that they have people who are under contract with the corporations whose chemicals they're studying for their impact on public health. And in the case of BPA, a German scientist, Wolfgang de Kant, has acknowledged having something like 18 different contracts with the polycarbonate industry, the BPA producing chemical corporations. And he was a member of the European Food Safety Authority panel that dictated the panel's lack of concern with BPA. And he clearly had a big impact on that, and he had not accurately reported his conflicts of interest. And he recently publicly announced that he was resigning from some European Commission panel because he was too busy, because somebody in the Le Monde article had, you know, blown the whistle on him and shown that he had these conflicts. Well, this turns out to be true for a, you know, substantial number of people on the EFSA panels. So they need to tighten up their ethics and conflict rules in order to have the public have faith in their decision making.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the US situation, where we have the FDA's hands essentially being tied unless there is very, very compelling evidence that there's a problem with a product, is it not the case that most of the research with respect to BPA is industry funded? And if that's the case, what hope is there that research is going to be produced that's not compromised?
Well, actually, BPA is a very unique situation because for most chemicals, industry is providing the only information we have about them. But because so many articles started to be published between 2000 and 2005 or six, in 2008, associated with the stimulus money, the National Institute of Health decided to put millions of dollars into BPA research with the idea that it would become essentially the model endocrine disrupting chemical about which they would know a huge amount. The disappointing aspect of the fact that there have been then this explosion of publications about bisphenol A is that the regulatory system is still saying, we don't know how to interpret these studies because they're not traditional toxicology studies. They're using modern approaches, genetic approaches, and molecular approaches that are never used in toxicological studies for regulatory purposes. And the regulators are just saying, well, we don't know what to do with them, so we'll ignore them. And EFSA is still doing that.
So we have a situation then where, because of this confusion, then industry can produce statements such as we find on that website factsaboutbpa.org, which you say is an industry-funded website. I mean, I read one of their pages where it says that all the worries about BPA is a lot of myths, really. They have myths and realities. So they list all these things, causing women to miscarry, breast cancer, the problem with having it, food storage, polycarbonates, or all these things. That's all myth. The reality is that it's all safe. And as we said before, do you think it is then that they are simply exploiting the confusion about all the things that you've just been discussing in order to make these amazingly confident statements here about the safety of BPA?
Well, if you believe in a weight of the evidence approach, where you actually look at all of the studies out there, the great majority of studies show harm. The only studies that don't show harm are produced by the chemical industry. So what they're actually really saying is our studies show bisphenol A to be completely safe, and the regulatory system only uses our studies to make decisions, and so therefore they conclude BPA is safe. The reality is, if you actually look at modern approaches to science using the tools of molecular biology and 21st century science instead of essentially early 20th century science, which is what the kind of studies they're basing the decisions on by EFSA and the FDA, then this is a pretty scary chemical. So everything that the American Chemistry Council is saying on that BPA.org website is propaganda, but it's not reflecting what is really out there in the scientific literature.
Now, I guess the burning question, which I expect many listeners to the Mind Renewed will be wanting me to ask you, is if there's any way in which we can make changes in our lives to minimize our exposure to this substance. So what do you advise that we do?
Well, I would advise that you do what I do. I have the ability in our lab. We have what is called a validated assay for bisphenol A using very sophisticated equipment called a tandem mass spectrometer. And my BPA levels are very, very low. And the reason is that when I go to a store and somebody wants to give me a receipt, I won't touch the receipt. If I have to have it for some reason, I'll put it into something like an envelope. because the BPA that coats the surface of that is like invisible talcum powder. Anything that receipt touches, if you put it in your pocket or your wallet or anything, it contaminates anything else that goes in there. And once it gets on your skin, if your skin is moist or you've used hand sanitizer or something, it can penetrate into your body very rapidly. And so I avoid contact with any kind of receipt paper. I avoid any kind of canned product. I drink nothing and I eat nothing out of cans. That's a huge source of exposure to bisphenol A.
Is it true also of cartons too? Are they lined as well?
It depends on the kind of resin that would be used. And one of the problems the public faces is that this is all declared to be confidential information. And not only do you, as a member of the public, not know what's in that, none of the regulatory agencies know what the lining is made out of. And that's in that 2010 FDA statement. They actually explicitly say, we don't even have the authority to get these corporations to tell us what products have BPA in them. So it's not that we're just ignorant. The entire regulatory system is ignorant of where these chemicals are being used.
And is it true also that this chemical is involved in plastic casings for televisions and computers and the like?
Yes. And it's also used in polyvinyl chloride toys because PVC is hard but brittle, and BPA is hard and not brittle. So you add these horrible chemicals called phthalates to PVC to make it soft, and then you add BPA to bring it back to a different kind of hardness. So your typical baby doll will have two very harmful kind of chemicals, phthalates and bisphenol A in it. Mm-hmm. So many plastic products, television, you know, helmets, computer screens, yes. And when you heat up that item, you're going to off-gas BPA.
Does this also apply to cling film as well, that you might put over food and then put it into a microwave?
No, BPA would typically not be used in them, although we have found cling film that has had BPA in it, but not all cling film does. And one of the important things is all of these plastic uses of BPA, there are alternative plastics such as polyethylene that are inherently safer and could be used to replace BPA. The Japanese replaced the can lining surface material being BPA. That is no longer the case in Japanese cans that are made in Japan. They do not have BPA as the surface lining. That was done 14 years ago. And the American and European can manufacturers still claim there's no alternative. And when you point out to them that the Japanese did it a long time ago, they kind of get a little embarrassed.
Yeah. So what would you say the situation is then? So if I cut out the use of food from cans and I no longer drink my water from bottles and I'm very careful about what I pick off the shelf and I don't touch the till receipts, nevertheless, I have this television, I have this computer, I have a car which has a dashboard that's made. I don't know whether that's involved in that as well. How can I possibly keep my hands off all these products?
The answer is that's why nobody out there has no BPA in them. This is a ubiquitous contaminant. Everybody's got some, but the epidemiology that I went through, the human studies show very clearly the likelihood of having diabetes, of heart disease, of all kinds of reproductive problems and neurobiological problems. The lower your levels of this chemical, the healthier you're likely to be. And so anything you can do, such as avoiding canned products and avoiding touching these receipts and avoiding buying plastic that doesn't say BPA free, then you will reduce your exposures to this chemical. And anything you can do that reduces your exposures will make you healthier.
And so we can actually reverse many of the effects of this chemical.
Yes, it's not a long-lived chemical in your body. It's not like dioxin or the chemical DDT or these flame retardants that can last in your body for decades. In fact, BPA is cleared out within a number of days from your body, and it isn't stored at high levels. And so if you essentially shut off the tap and are not being exposed to it, as an adult, the consequences of being exposed to it can be reversed. Just like a woman taking a birth control pill, it controls and suppresses her ability to reproduce. But when she stops taking that pill, her body can recover. The problem with fetuses is that when pregnant women or newborn babies are exposed to this during these critical periods in development, and that developmental event is damaged, then that is irreversible. So the imperative for developing babies and fetuses to be protected from this chemical is really critical. And the French regulatory agency, ANSES, is in the process of trying to get this out of all products that are used to contain food by 2015. EFSA is fighting the French attempts to do this tooth and nail, but it looks like the French are holding strong on this and intend to do it because there are alternatives already on the market that we know are safer than BPA.
And I suppose as consumers, then we can help to drive that situation by avoiding BPA products and therefore forcing the market in a more healthy direction.
And that's happening all over the world, where people are looking at products that say BPA free and they're choosing them. And it's really the marketplace that's driving the change by the industry, not the regulatory system. It's simply like what happened with the baby bottles. People stopped buying them. You know, it became very obvious this was no longer a viable way to make baby bottles and expect people to buy them.
Yeah, sure. So before we close, is there anything else that you feel that we've missed out in this conversation that you think would be important to add?
Well, one last thing that's been a very disappointing and kind of scary aspect of these chemicals is that we used to focus on the ability of chemicals to cause classic mutations in the genetic code. And now we realize that hormones and hormone-disrupting chemicals like BPA, what they do is they alter the ability of genes to function. And this is a critical part of normal development. It's why you begin as one cell and you have nerve cells and muscle cells and skin cells that all have the same genes, but in the skin cell, the nerve cell genes are turned off. Well, this process of turning on and off genes is called epigenetics, outside the normal study of genetics. And it's this turning on and off of genes that is what is leading to these lifetime inability of that system to function normally. And horrifyingly, we're finding that these abnormal marks that turn off or on genes inappropriately are being transmitted across generations in a way that nobody thought 20 years ago was possible. So we're seeing these causing transgenerational abnormalities. So if a grandmother is exposed to a chemical her grandchildren and great-grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren can suffer abnormalities due to that exposure. Nobody thought that was possible. That kind of environmental impact was attributed to a person named Lamarck, and everybody thought that idea was crazy. Well, it turns out there's some truth to it, not in the way he described it, but we now understand substantially the molecular biology of that. And it's really scary.
And as this is such an important subject, in the way that you've described it, even more important than I realized just because of what you've just said, could you direct people towards resources that would be of help to them to understand this more?
Yes, the World Health Organization, together with the United Nations, UNEP, just published a major report on endocrine-disrupting chemicals. And the WHO report is really becoming a guide for concern about them. And it mentions many of these types of problems that we're talking about and is online and available to the public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I shall locate that and I shall put that in the show notes for people to find easily enough. Well, Dr. Von Saal, it has been a great privilege to have you on the program. You've given us a great deal of information to consider, and I think this conversation will be very helpful for many people. It's certainly been helpful for me. So may I say thank you very much indeed for sparing all this time to talk with us on the show.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you.